Welcome to This Week in FX PhD, your weekly wrap-up and behind the scenes at fxphd.com.
Hi, and welcome to This Week at FX PhD. John Montgomery with you, and as I always say, is joined by my friend and illustrious business partner, Mike Seymour. How's it going, my friend?
Good, sir. How are you?
Fantastic. Really enjoying this term so far.
Yeah, no, it's good.
Really been having a lot of fun hanging out at Magnopus last week. So Ben Grossman and Alex Henning talking about VR, along with Scott Squires, too. Ben wasn't in the video, of course, but chatting with him about some of the stuff they're doing. They're really doing some interesting things.
What a
there.
Bunch of talentless hacks.
Yeah, I know.
Who want to be sitting in that room with that group?
Those guys are like, yes.
And it reminds me, I remember a really good friend of ours who's a director, but I won't name him, but he's a really good director. Anyway, he very early in his career ran into, was invited to an event as a kind of a young filmmaker. And the event was when George Lucas was in town shooting Star Wars. Anyway, so he leaves this room where George Lucas is talking early because he's really hungry. And he figures if he gets to the buffet table thingy outside first, he'll get something to actually eat. And it so happens that Lucas went out early as well. Mm-hmm. So he walks into this room and he's like literally got a little plastic plate with, you know, stacked high as many chips and nachos as he could get. And George Lucas is there. And like, that's the only two people in the room. And so he's like, hi. And George Lucas is like, and clearly there's a whole entourage that for some reason is behind George Lucas, but stopped at the door to discuss something. And so he says, what are you doing? And so, you know, our friend says that he's a young filmmaker and he's working on like a little animated film and stuff. And so Lucas, just being a nice guy and almost without thinking, says, oh, well, you should contact ILM because we're all looking for good people. And he just says, oh, I wouldn't want to work there. And Lucas just like suddenly snaps at him like with another stare as if to say, what? He's like, no, because everyone's so talented. I would like never stand out. I could never. And then, of course, the room suddenly then immediately fills because whoever was blocking the door discussing whatever just opens and they all walk in and start saying hi to George Lucas. And all they really got was, no, it was just that they were really talented. For God's sake. It's just be me. You know, that sort of moment where you just blow it.
Exactly.
But you don't mean to blow it, right? It was like an honest sentiment. Like, I mean, I would totally agree. If I went to work at ILM, I would be not anywhere near one of the people that you would call the brightest people that worked at ILM. I mean, like, you know, it's just a formidable array of talent. But so when I was joking about you at Magnus, I was like, yes, a very, very clever group of people, and I was only joking when I said a talentless group of hacks.
yes, that would be that'd be my place. I mean, it is really one of the great things about FXP machine, actually being able to bring those people actually to our members as well. You know, the friends and professional relationships that we built over the years, it's really awesome. I mean, you'd you know, probably if you'd asked me a decade ago, Mike, would I be in a room with, you know, Academy Award-winning VFX supervisors and award winners. I'm like, yeah, I don't think so. Hopefully, you know, that would be a good day. That'd be a great day. So, and it was.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny, isn't it? You, because I mean, I think both you and I are at heart, you know, just total fans of the industry.
Right.
I mean, I'm not killing myself to hang out with stars in the film, but I get, you know, like, put me next to Dennis Muren and I'm like, oh, it's Dennis Muren. And I've met him several times, right? It's not like I don't know him.
Well,
I've interviewed him, and but still, it's like,
let's
oh my
use
God.
A case in point about this, right? At the SciTech Awards. So I didn't recently, but I have been on the carpet with you as well as actually gone in and
yeah,
taken
sure.
part in them. And it's actually really funny because during... everyone's coming in and lining up on the red carpet and people asking their names. And it's funny because as Mike and I are photographing these people, they all know us and they say something to us. And all the photographers are kind of looking at us like we're kind of odd. It's like, how do they know this? What's the kind of deal coming on? And then when the actual stars come on, we do take photos of them, of course. But we are far less interested in the hosts than we were actually the people attending the awards to receive their awards. And it always kind of throws the photographers for a loop when we're there doing that. And to your point.
Yeah, I was standing next to New York Magazine, I think it was, or something, or New York Times or something at the last Oscars. And it was, you know, I was really keen to get photos of several of the people that were up for SciTech Oscars for the technical stuff that they'd done. But when it actually came to the stars of, in that case, I think it was Wolf of Wall Street and stuff like that, I was like, well, that's okay, you go. And they're like, do you have questions? And I'm like, no, nope, I'm pretty good.
Exactly. Like, I mean, got some nice photos. Yeah, didn't take photos of them. No, I'm not sure, saying that, right? But yeah, it's
I did say to Margot, how did she find a US cruise over Australian cruise? And she like did that double take where you're like, I recognize that accent.
Yes, exactly.
But then she's too clever to give a flippant answer, knowing that that's the kind of stuff that becomes clickbait. Hey, I was at an interesting event last night on Shotgun,
yeah,
which was kind of fun. So in this interesting event that I was at on Shotgun, they were discussing stuff. Yeah, it was all great. And then there was a second bit, which was somebody from Rising Sun Pictures actually giving a specific talk about their experiences with Shotgun. And because the first bit had kind of covered all of the what you'd call PowerPoint bits, he just said, you know what? This is Ian. You know Ian. He's a great guy. Ian said, why don't I just open up my actual Shotgun account and see if I can do it remotely from this pub we're in. And I'll just, you know, rather than go through a kind of a canned presentation, we were like, way to go, Ian. Sure. Which he did, right? Which was awesome, because then he, you know, walked us through stuff. Now, he walked us through stuff that he was allowed to walk us through. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like he was violating anything that he shouldn't be allowed to do. And while he was talking about projects that they're currently on, and Rising Sun are doing things like Pan and Tarzan and Gods of Egypt, we saw nothing that we shouldn't have seen, right? We saw trailer stuff. But then he went back to a project that clearly Rising Sun have permission to talk about, which was X-Men. And they did, if you remember, the scene in the Pentagon when they're doing the breakout and Quicksilver runs around the room in slow motion. And so as opposed to normal presentations where this is, you know, just, and theoretically you could have a shot here that does this, it was actual shots. And so he said, well, let's look at shot, I think it was like 0200. And I was like, you know, really interested in what he was doing, because A, I liked the show. I thought that was a really good film. And B, it's really genuinely interesting to see when you see real files, not sort of ones that have been watered down. And that, I just wrote down some of the stats. So I'm sure he won't mind me quoting this, because he was saying them out loud. Mm-hmm. But that was like in their thing. It was like duration for the shot, 212.85 days. I want to know what they didn't do on the last 0.15 of a day.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? It's like, don't book the whole day, because we only worked like 85% of the day after 212 days. So anyway, yes. And then this is the other thing that I thought was really great, because, you know, this is stuff that was singled out by the visual effects community as being spectacularly good work. So this was not the product of bad visual effects supervising, bad effects, problems. This was none of that. This was just hard work, and it was hard to do, and so that's how it ran, right? But it was like, how many versions of the comp do you reckon that the nuke guy did of that shot? Want to pick it a guess? Like, how many versions he published before they showed it to, you know, like so you do a version and save it with a, and as you know, in Shotgun, it publishes. So it's not like you have to, not every time you look at it, it logs it. It's like every time you get to a point where you effectively are saving it, you're publishing it into the system, it gets a version numbering. So you're a compositor, John. You know, how many times do you reckon a shot would be...
I am so anal about saving. I'm like counting the days.
Oh, it's not just save, it's saving and publishing, right?
Like, right.
Yeah, so it's that you expect it to be in the system and formally logged.
Yes, and logged. It's got to be...
I'll give you the answer. 228 times.
I was actually going to say, okay, that's. I was going to say potentially it was be like 1.5 times as many days as it was. Average of 1.5 saves a day is what I was thinking.
Well, now of course this is
published, right? Not so that's, saves, yeah.
And you're probably right, because in fact I said that the whole thing, it was like 247 days from turnover to delivery, but obviously most of that wasn't in comp. So there were multiple times that it was published from comp. But then I wanted to know, okay, so if that's how many times he published it, how many times did the supervisor put it up in front of the director to get it reviewed? And again, I want to totally emphasize, this is me repeating this because it's a real world window, not because I'm making fun of it or I think it was bad. I think it was, you know, this is how it runs, right? At the high end when you're doing major work with some of like a really hard shot that was I think, spectacularly well done by Rising Sun. 42 times. Wow. So for 42 times, they ran it to get notes and back on the hero shot of him running around the room at the Pentagon. I thought that was pretty interesting.
That's fun.
So there were 16 pages of notes taken from those 42 meetings or 42, you know, CineSync wow. sessions or whatever it was. And I just want to, just to back up what I just previously said, they didn't actually change the cut on this. So before you sort of jump to conclusions, oh, they must have like...
Right.
This was a sequence that was very well planned.
Edit-wise.
And they did turnover and they didn't re-edit it. They didn't like come back and add shots. They didn't come back and say, you know that guy, I think you should have purple hair, not blue. They didn't sort of say, oh, you know, no, that's all done wrong. I know of another project like that where they were literally, you know, in like halfway through a very large number of reviews and the supervisor decided to change what renderer they were using on it. Like, what? But all the shaders, yeah, we'll just redo them. What? But no, that wasn't the case. In Rising Sun's case, it was just, and you know, Rising Sun's been in business for 20 years. But the reason that they were there is that they were one of the first, if not sort of the first, independent companies that were a Shotgun customer.
Oh.
So back in the day,
they were
one of the first to... So they really know what they're talking about. It's a really good presentation. But it was just so fun because they're so comfortable walking around in Shotgun and stuff. They were just really happy to go in and kind of actually show us for real. And that was a really good thing because I have been with companies and gone through their Shotgun things, but never quite like had 45 minutes of just interrogating them over sort of how it kind of ran. And it's really interesting. And of course, you know, this gets back to a point we've made in PhD many times, the importance of the post job audit, that keeping track of how long things took to do, you know, especially and now in commercials, not so much in features. It's so important that when you go to quote the next time you have a shot like that, that you can look up and say, you know what, that shot, when you think about it, was similar to that other shot we did, and that other shot took 247 days from turnover, so I don't see why this one would be any different, as opposed to going, no, I think we could do that in 3 months. Really? That'd be 90 days. Feels like it. You know, that's such a wealth of commercial benefit in having that corporate memory that you can just refer to your previous work. Now, maybe there's a good reason why you can now do it in 90 days instead of 247, and you know, there's no reason that that wouldn't be the case, but technology changes. But understanding exactly where things are, why they are the way they are, really, really, really good.
Something I learned far too late, far later than I should have, actually. I needed a finishing 101 conversation with the producer and Jeff Huser to help me work through some of that, actually, because that's one of the interesting things that they pointed out about bidding jobs. It's like, it's not just bidding, but it's post-mortem after all jobs.
Yep.
Really understanding what you take away with it, so the next time you can be better and do better and be more predictable with or more accurate with your prediction on how long something's going to take.
Yeah, no, totally. I think that's so important. It's human nature. You tend to block out the things. Now, again, I'm not talking about Rising Sun anymore.
Yeah.
You tend to block out the things that went bad, and you just remember the things that go good. And it's like, you know, in a perfect world, ... And the trouble is, it isn't ever a perfect world. It's an average of perfect and terrible, but you tend to remember the good and forget the bad. And what you need to remember is that average, you know?
Yeah.
Okay, for every job that I did manage to get done in a week, there was the one that took 2 weeks. So we should probably not bid a week. We should probably bid 10 days.
So in Jeff's conversation, there was something came up about serial underbidding or overbidding or spot on. Which were you?
Well, I had a pretty hard-ass producer. I think she tended to
left to your own devices. So you sound like me and Jeff. Frankly,
glass was a bit half full for me if left my own devices. But then I wasn't left my own devices.
I chalk it up to I always wanted to do more to something. I always wanted to. I felt like I wanted to take more time on each and every shot. That's my excuse for serial overbidding.
Yeah, it's an interesting problem, isn't it? I mean, you know, you want to do the best thing you possibly can. We're discussing this over in the supervisor's course as well. You want to do the best job you possibly can. At some point, you need to get it shipped. But also there's a problem of like, well, who gets to say when it's good enough?
Yeah.
Because I think one of the things that I am aware of, again, absolutely not referring to Rising Sun, is that company that would probably have a director that would approve stuff, but there's an independent producer between the director and the effects mm-hmm. house, and they want it looking really good for their reel. And at what point are they protecting the show's interest, and at what point are they just, you know, wanting it really, really good because it's not their money that they're spending? They're either spending the film's money or they're spending goodwill capital with the effects house. And it's a nightmare if you think, well, if I could only get this to the director, they'd approve it. But the guy that's the gatekeeper is kind of stopping that. The flip side, of course, is that you actually want the gatekeeper, who should theoretically be the expert in the area, to advise mm-hmm. the director when they think you could do it better or differently. So, yeah, very complicated. It's kind of a miracle that any film ever gets made and out the door, but, you know, obviously it does.
Well, and then, of course, you've got commercials, which is really interesting because you have a very different dynamic and a different, you know, approval pipeline than you do in feature films. And creatives in general, you're going to work with a producer who's maybe going to be in a room during a supervised session. You'd have an art director and then a writer, sometimes a creative director who's above all of them. But depending upon the different creative group, generally creatives work in teams where you've got an art director and a writer and even a producer kind of working a lot together. Between those very teams, they all really have this really different personality and work dynamic that you as a flame finisher of some kind have to kind of ascertain and learn from, because in some situations the art director really has the final say at certain agencies and certain groups, but in others it might be almost even-handed between the writer and the art director, even though you might think it's the art director who has this final say. And then you have really strong producers sometimes with opinions who can frankly lead that discussion as well, maybe also with a better understanding of the client, because they're probably dealing with the client more. So they maybe kind of want to push an issue because they know it's not going to fly to a client. And then you take that all back and it goes to the client. So that was the thing about commercials, Mike, is just on a daily basis, that dynamic and that type of flow and approval workflow just varied dramatically.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't have a producer, actually. I had a bidder. I had someone who called herself an executive producer, but she could execute a big, you know,
bid. No, I had a proper producer.
Right? That wasn't I didn't have a producer, yeah. Right? So it was really difficult for me. But it's crazy, isn't it, how different it is from group to group?
Yeah, I mean, I had situations where the creative director I knew what he wanted, and the actual junior creator that was in the room was wanting something different. And I'm like, how do I get around this guy? Because clearly whatever he says is going to be countermanded by when the creative director walks in the room, who I've worked with on, you know, 20 campaigns. And ain't no way he wants this, right? Because he's all about, you know, I need to see that bigger, larger, more in front. And this other junior is trying to be all clever and bury it. And I'm like, no, that's not happening. And then the other one that is kind of funny also, which was a perennial problem, is when you had a director who you felt like was, you know, obviously primarily our client, but they were at odds with the agency, and you were kind of in the middle. And I think I've told the story before, but I remember I had the worst one ever when they actually just got so fed up with what this director wanted. They fired her in the room, and she was sitting next to me at the flame. They fired her, and I'm like, awkward. But then she starts crying, and I'm like, really awkward. And then then she just refuses to leave the room. She said, I'm not leaving. And I'm like, okay. And so I'm just sitting there.
I'd be sitting there going,
eyes down.
Someone page me. Please page me. Yeah. Someone page me.
Oh,
page
is that the fire alarm? Oh, no. Excuse me. I'm just sorry. Yeah, so I just sat there while this director sobbed beside me. And everyone was like just talking past her as if she wasn't there, because they were like, we don't know what to do and we need to keep moving and we're paying by the hour, so we're just going to walk around you and talk around you. And they just sat there, and it was just like, it was so heart-wrenchingly awkward. It was just... And I felt so I was kind of felt sorry for everyone in this scene, right? Because no one kind of needed to have got to that place, but they did. And there was no doubt there was blame all around, but it was just way badly managed. I mean, I certainly made my fair share of those blunders, but this particular case, I think I was pretty innocent.
No one sounds like you are.
It was almost like, I want it funnier, I want it sadder, I want it funnier, I want it sadder. Well, you need to do it our way because we're the agency. Well, no, you don't, because I'm the director. Okay, that doesn't work for us. Well, I insist. Well, I'm insisting back. Well, you're fired. It was like, I'll just keep working on this roto. I'll just keep my head down.
Yes. Yeah. That's when we'll cut to the Homer Simpson backing away gif. You know, that episode where he's just backing away. I'm out of here. Anyway. Yeah, interesting. It's very interesting. Good, you know, varied learning experience in how I deal with bidding jobs and things like that over time. And I think that was one of the more pressure, my bigger pressure points, actually, I think, was I felt like tremendous pressure to get that bid right on so many levels. You know, I didn't want to be the guy who said I underbid it. I didn't want to be the guy overbid it and lost the job. There really truly is a fine art to that.
You know, in the end,
doing it well.
In the end, that's where experience comes in, because there's just a point at which you can't teach somebody. I mean, we obviously try and give you tools to help you with situations, but there is a point at which you just have to have done the hours and experienced some of those things and found a way that works for you to get through them. And if you are in one of those awkward situations, I think my only advice to you is just, and it sounds so like a bad motivational poster, but I have actually said it to myself, which is, you know, I'm just going to have to, I don't know, chalk this up to experience, think of this as a learning opportunity, whatever it is, you just have to say to yourself, this too will pass and I will know more after this than I did now and I'll just get through this.
Right.
Because there are some times where, it's just that it's going to hell fast and you're just like, oh no, oh no, oh no, I don't want to be here right now. So that scene in what's that film, Speed, where it's just like, I can't be here right now, we're going back to the airport, I can't be here right now, but you know, you kind of you are. And that's there. Yeah, there's just nothing for it. I mean, when you see a really experienced supervisor or somebody in that situation, they can normally diffuse, handle it, move it. So I guess look to them. But if you're the only one in the room, yeah, sometimes you just have to, all right, some point I will go home and be able to commiserate with my loved one that wasn't the best day I had.
And at some point, and you hang in there, you'll get to the point where you feel like you can. I mean, I really felt that way in the end, that I could pretty much handle most any situation fairly well. Not to say I didn't handle a few badly, but at least I think I could do it well and react and know how to deal with those various situations over time. It's something that comes with experience, and especially in our background, Mike, and the type of work we did working with the agencies and creatives and a lot of supervised session, you just develop those tools. But yes, it's experience for sure. Hey, speaking of Flame, by the way.
Yes.
How many people do you think we have RSVP to the Flame Music Group here in LA tomorrow that we're leading?
I guess you have no idea. I have no idea, except for the fact that you were quite enthusiastic about who was going to be presenting and doing stuff there. I noticed that happening on the...
Yeah, it's great. We've got Mark Renton, who's actually taught some classes for us in the past at FXPhD, and he's going to kind of do some cool... kind of almost philosophic, artistic approaches to using Flame and how to use the 3D geometry efficiently and quick in a session and really add those nice little finishing touches of thing. But we've got Greg Paul Malone showing off some cool tricks in action. And, of course, he won the new original, last year's One Frame of 408 competition. And then Drone's coming down from ILM to actually show some really cool...
That's right.
Some really cool tips and tricks. Utilizing CG and some new shaders and renderers, as well as actually he's going to bring a VR monitoring headset setup for monitoring VR in Flame. So you can have a headset and view that. So that should be a lot of fun. We're hoping to announce him, but he's really deep in the throes of production, so I'm really happy that ILM let him get out for a day. But yeah, it's 160 people signed up for it. So
that would be good.
That's actually pretty good, yeah. We had about 100 in the last one, so we're really excited. In fact, we're kind of a little worried it's going to be too tight at Framestore. But I think, as you and I like to say about people joining FXPhD, that's a good problem to have. Have people show up to a party is a good thing. So it'll be good. I think it's going to be a great section of artists, and I think it's great. It might you should do it in Australia. Someone was just trying to pimp that on the group the other day, trying to find a place for a group.
I would happily do that.
Because you have some
that.
Super hardware coming in.
Yeah. Hey, I had a question for you. Have you looked, I'm looping back to where we started, but have you looked at Flame Shotgun integration?
Yeah, it's frankly really quite lacking at this point in time. It's really not where it needs to be, because the way it happens, it's is A lot of the publishing and things happen at the start of a render. Just and a lot of that's mic because of how Flame works. And so what's happened is they got the first integration out there, which I don't mean to trash it, but it's great that we have this integration. But in practicality, until you start using those tools in production on a daily basis and trying to integrate them in a facility, you really honestly don't really know how it's all going to work out. So they've been really hard at work, I know, in modifying stuff both on the Flame software side and at Shotgun to make it better. And hopefully by the end of the year, we'll have something that's really kick-ass. It's good right now, obviously far better than the island that it was before. It's nice that both those teams are in-house and able to kind of share information in a way that they haven't in the past. And I think it's going to be even better with this next rev that they're doing in the software.
The story I put up on FX Guide on the work that the commercials team at Framestore have done with Shotgun had a really interesting point that made me think about it, which was the dependency graph that they've got working on a comp. So let's say I wanted to publish something. I want to archive something. Mm-hmm. You can basically say, okay, so this shot here, I want to archive it and anything that it relied on. And yes. So instead of having to archive everything, you just say, these six shots, archive me this and any cache, any asset that it used. So obviously, that's very different from like any rendered plate that went into it, because obviously, you know, you would know on a setup if you... on a Flame or whatever, you would, you know, clear your desktop and say load this setup, and any clips that it required would get popped up on the desktop, and you go great. But that's far beyond that, because it's saying, okay, well, these were the models that we used in the rendering of the clips that you are using in the final comp. And it just seemed to me like such a genius kind of thing to do. And they were like, instead of terabytes and terabytes on every commercial, we just say these are the primary assets of the Nuke or the soon to have Hero finishing, and we'll archive that. And similarly, if you want to revise a shot or do something, we're going to be able to load from the archive this and anything that this used or was used to make this, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
That seemed like, as soon as I heard that, I was like, oh my God.
I think it's brilliant, because that's, as you know, that's really a difficult thing to do in the old school Flame world. And that's something obviously the Shotgun can do really well. And keeping track of that. Yeah, I really enjoyed reading that article about how they were using it.
And I was thinking in Flame, that would be exactly what I would want. I would like Flame as part of my CG pipeline to have that its role in the dependency graph. So you could say, yeah, you know, I use these three characters and I rendered them and I use this fluid sim and this cache and this is the Olympic file and, you know, there is the Flame file that, and there's the renders. And thanks. Of course, one of the reasons that that's very important and in features, not now, having talking about commercials, is right. That if you wanted to hand off a shot to another facility, you need to be able to. And so I know that a lot of places have stuff for extracting. You know, okay, here's our asset, and we've stripped out everything that was proprietary so that it's in a folder. So if you were to open the folder at another facility, it would actually open. Whereas, as you know, in the old days, you'd go to open a folder and it'd be like, well, these eight files are missing, and three of them are proprietary formats I've never even heard of. So that's not going to work. I'm going to have to rebuild these things. And that was a huge problem. But with more and more facilities, you know, sharing material, and especially through things like Olympic, it is possible now to have a level of abstraction that allows a shot or parcel of shots moved from facility to facility. But it's not so important in commercials. But that's, and so I sort of was discounting it at commercials level. But that idea of the archiving is totally valid in commercials.
Yeah, and the fact is, though, and you have places like The Mill and, The Mill uses F-Track, not Shotgun. But you have these multi-city companies that are doing commercials work now with locations from L.A. to Chicago to London. They're really needing to have their Flame systems integrated with a system like Shotgun to make that work possible, you know, because that's very contrary to previous workflows with Flame, right? You know, you thought of it as the final place where things go. It's kind of an island almost, shareable among the Flames within a facility. But sharing and tracking those things between multiple facilities, impossible with Flame software alone, by far.
Hey, you're going to be having primarily commercials people, I'm guessing, at this Flame users group. If you're having a beer, I'd love to know what people are using for their actual scheduling, like bidding scheduling stuff. If you happen to be just having a chat, I don't need a professional survey or anything, but Because the guys that Framestore were using Cedar, which is CETA, Cedar is quite popular with a lot of commercial houses. I know FastTrack is used. I know Microsoft Project is used. We don't do a lot of stuff on the bidding stuff, though obviously I've been getting into it a bit because of the work we did with the Moon Unit and that whole document for doing a bid in commercials. And I was just curious at the commercials level. I mean, some people are just using Excel. And, but there must be other people that are using software that is sort of project management software to actually do, I guess, some
scheduling. Yeah, similar to what there used to be this company called Zytec and Zymox. I think they're actually still around. That's what a lot of places in Chicago ended up using.
But and I'm staff balancing.
Using it now. Yeah, staff, exactly.
Because getting load balancing on your staff and that sort of stuff, and that typically isn't, I don't think, in commercials, I'm pretty sure it isn't done inside, say, like a shotgun. I don't know if it is inside F-Track that it's being used. There's a difference between it being in the product and being used in the product, if you know what I mean.
Yep.
But, anyway, so if you are chatting to people,
we'll definitely do that.
And if you guys are listening and you use something other than like one of those products that we've just described, drop me an email because I'd love to hear. It's just one of those things I haven't had an eye on, and I haven't been in commercials production for a while, and so I've just kind of, it's moved on a bit, and I'm not quite sure what everyone's using. And it's not the sort of question that comes up if we're talking to someone, hey, your latest commercial. By the way, when you were bidding this, what software did you use for the scheduling?
Right, not exactly. Right. Huh? Where'd that come from kind of answer?
Exactly.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm curious. That's interesting. I'm curious as well. And then where were some of the other ones that used to be used, like a farmer's wife?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Right? That was one. I'm curious to see them. I used to know several people or several facilities who used that, but I'm curious what's being used now.
Yeah. Me too.
Be interesting to see. Well, hey, my friend, I need to get going this evening.
Me too.
But it's, as always, been a delight.
Yeah, it's been fun talking.
And a treasure chatting to you. Maybe not
about
treasure.
A treasure, but yeah.
It's been fun. Let's just say fun.
It's a bit warm and cuddly. A bit unicorn tears.
It's
steady, man.
It's late in the day. Time for a martini.
No, it's not. It's kind of time for another latte.
Yes. Thanks so much for taking the time to listen, everyone. Thanks for being a part of FX PhD, and we'll talk to you next week. Bye.
See you guys.
Thanks for listening. This podcast is copyright FX PhD.